Recording has started. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the Translation and Transliteration of Contact Information PDP Working Group on Thursday, the 5th of June, 2014. On the call today, we have Justin Chu, Chris Dillon, Peter Green, May Sirchapin Sarawat, Wanawit Akuptra, Rudy Van Snick, Petter Reinforth, Jennifer Chung, and Wolf Nobin. We have apologies from Jim Galvin. From staff, we have Julie Hedlund, Lars Hoffman, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would also like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Chris.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, so let's move into number three on the agenda, and this is just the usual point on statements of interest, whether anybody has a change in the statements of interest since last week. Okay, seeing none, I'll just move into the next point. And this is the responses from SOs and ACs, and a couple of points I'd just like to say before we start with this, because I think it will be most of today's call. And one is just to say that Jim did have a few questions about the summary that we were discussing last week, and he's not on the call this week, but I'm just making the point that I haven't forgotten about that, so I will be back on that case next next week, and specifically, I know that he was interested in response number 39, which I think is one of the ones from the Thai GAC. So I think he will want to ask questions about that quite soon, possibly next week. And now the other thing, I'll just say before we get down to work going through documents is that we had a major new document this week, which was circulated on the mailing list, but I will just draw your attention to it now, and that is the study to evaluate available solutions for the submission and display of internationalized contact data. And that's quite a long report. It's about 50 pages. It's extremely interesting, and it is relevant to what we are doing. It is, as I was saying, it is quite a long report, and so what I would like to suggest is that I'm going to do it in order, so we'll just work through the documents that are already in the queue for our attention, and then we'll come to that one. But I think the earliest I think that we could come back to that one later in the call. And apart from just generally reading it, because it is a long document, I would like you to pay particular attention to any parts of that document that are about script that you know. So there are specific parts of the document on the Han script and on Arabic script and various other scripts. And the reason I'm flagging that up is because those are the parts of that document that we can't really spend very much time on as we go through it. So if you can be ready for any additional points on specific scripts, that will really speed us through the document. What I was trying to say earlier, and it didn't come out right, I think, was I think the earliest we would get to that would be next week, in fact, because we do have quite a pile of stuff to do today. And there's also some stuff in the wiki here. Julie is showing people where it is in the wiki. I think I put a couple of links in the wiki as well just a couple of days ago. So, okay, I think there are one or two points of, now let me have a look there. I think there are some things later. Yes, so there are, apparently there are a couple of things of any other business. So we'll, I'm intending just to sort of run until about 10 to 3 British time, and then we can deal with those. So that's about 45 minutes from now. Okay, any questions about any of that, or shall we just return to what we were doing last week and then move on from the end of that document to other documents? Okay, well, last week we had got about halfway through the interim report from the Expert Working Group on Internationalized Registration Data. I'll just see if I can find a quick link to that. The chat room. Oh, yes, apparently it will come up in a moment. Now, we got, in fact, we're only looking at two pages of that report. We were looking at page 17 last week, and we're going to do page 18 this week. And we'll start at the top. The various bullet points actually aren't numbered, but I'm giving them numbers because we really need numbers so that we know which point we're talking about. So the point at the top of the page is I'm going to call number 6. And now let me have a look. Okay, and we can actually see that coming up on the screen. And I reckon that number 6 for me is a relatively simple question. Eventually there had to be something simple here, and I think this is it. It is, so it actually says, we can see it. If there are two versions of the registration data, which version should be considered primary or authoritative if there is a mismatch? And I'll just put one little explanation here, but I guess what we're talking about is we're talking about a version of the data which is perhaps in the original script. So we might use Chinese characters as an example. So say we've got one version which is in Chinese characters, and we've got the other version which is in one of the Chinese romanizations, Pinyin. So in a case like that, which is the authoritative version? And what I would like to say is that for me, the answer really and truly is that the original Chinese script version is authoritative. So I guess by saying that, what I'm really doing is looking out for opinions which differ from that. So if there are people out there who would like to make a case for a romanization or some form which is not the original script, original language version, then that we are very interested in. But you know, for me, I can see Petter agreeing with that. For me, this is actually a relatively simple question. For me, it really is the original version. But that said, obviously, if there's somebody out there wanting to make another case, then it's not that we're not interested. Okay, moving on to the next point, which is number 7. Or at least in my system it's number 7, then we've got if translated / transliterated versions of the data are required, how will data be maintained simultaneously in multiple languages or scripts? Should there be additional meta-level information? So, again, the suggestion here would be that I think very often what would tend to happen would be that perhaps there may be a change in the original script version, and then some other version, a romanized version, may change. So often it would be that way round, although I suppose one could imagine a situation where there was an obvious typo in the romanization. So I don't know, somebody had written paging instead of Beijing, so that just needs to be fixed. But that would be a situation where the pinyin or the romanization, which is not the original form, gets changed. And then we have the other question, should there be additional meta-level information? And here, really and truly, the answer one would expect would be yes, because otherwise, you know, actually, how do we know what these versions are? You know, particularly something that's Roman, Romanized. You know, what kind of data is that? It is actually a very important issue. But later on, when we come to have a look at the study to evaluate available solutions for the submission and display of internationalized contact data, probably next week, if we continue to make good progress, then I've lost track of what I was saying. So. Generally, that would be the case. But in fact, that study has looked at a survey of what has actually happened, and one of the interesting things about the survey is that nobody is using metadata so far. So, you know, this means that if we do say that metadata is required, that is substantially different from what is happening at the moment. So that's really the point I wanted to make about that. Anything else about number 7? I think we've got a few technical problems. It may be better just to copy the URL out of the chat and get the URL going in a separate browser window. That often works quite well if we've got technical hiccups. I'm sitting here with paper copies. Really have not gone electronic at all. It's all paper here. Okay. So if there aren't any other points about that question, then we end up with number 8, which is the last one. And this is something we've actually already spoken about previously, but it's saying, for company and individual names, should translation or transliteration be required? And heavens, twice in one meeting. I think this is an easy question, because in the case of names, usually, we really do want transliteration. There may be some exceptions, but translating Beijing into Northern Capital is profoundly unhelpful. So often it will just be translation Beijing. We don't want to translate names. But again, looking at the report that I was referring to earlier, the study to evaluate available solutions, that does actually highlight a few cases where I think there's a Russian one in there, and it says transliterating into Praspiek-Lenina, which really what you want is something like Lenin Avenue, but. Actually, if you transliterate, you get this this other form, which is rather more difficult to understand. So it's not completely black and white, this one, but very often transliterate. I think predominantly, perhaps the answer is transliteration, but there are some issues. I would suspect that the Universal Postal Union's rules on postal addresses will solve many of these problems, because they actually have dedicated rules for addresses in many countries. So I guess probably a summary might be that Most of the time it's transliteration, but there may be cases of translation, and there are also cases where the order of an address is changed. So I think one of the addresses was some German street where you had something like Lindenstraße, which actually became, I know that's the same order, isn't it? Oh, I know what it was. It was Lindenstraße followed by a number, number 8 or something like that. Actually, it was 23, but oh well. And that becomes 23 Linden Street or 23 Lindenstraße in English. So there's actually a change in the order, and that sort of thing is quite common. We're having quite a lot of technical problems today. All I can say is just copy the URL and then fire up the report in a separate window, and that means you're not relying on Adobe Connect's problems. And that actually brings us to the end of this particular document that we've been looking through. So that's the interim report from the Expert Working Group on Internationalized Registration Data. So before we move on to the next document, I'll just ask whether there is anything else we want to say about that. I mean, actually, we've really only picked up quite a small part of that document as well, but it did. I think we have to address all 8 of these questions, and they have been copied into our page on this subject, so they have been added to proposed questions and taxonomies, which is number 4 in our wiki. Okay, seeing no comments in Adobe, we can now possibly move on, and this then ends up being, I think it's the status update report. So this is status update report from the Expert Working Group on GTLD Directory Services. I will presume that we may still continue to have technical problems, so I will just copy the URL straight into the chat so that you can use another tab in your browser. Wait a minute. Yes, that looks right. That URL is actually is broken, so you need to actually remove the content before the www, and then it should work. Actually, maybe it's quicker if I fix that. Okay, that looks more as if it may be helpful. And I'll just wait a moment whilst we fire up that. And specifically this time, we're looking at pages 23 to 31, which cover validation. Adobe Connect seems to be happy with us. Let's hope that continues. Oh. Yes. This is looking less pleasant. Yes, I think the old-fashioned approach of preferably paper, but failing that, another tab in the browser is the way forwards. Well, the report starts off with a list of what we can consider to be the benefits of validation. We have, unfortunately, we still, or at least I have problems seeing the report in Adobe Connect. So, wait a minute, things are happening. Perhaps it will come right. Of hourglass now. Yes, that looks really good. No, but it's fallen over again. I think no, we still have technical problems there. I think the best thing to do is just open it separately. I mean, the only problem is that it does become more difficult to see what's going on in Adobe Connect, but at least we can have a look at that document. I think it might be some kind of memory issue. Coming back to it, we have basically quite a list of benefits of validation on page 23. So this is things like increased accuracy of contact information by using pre-validated contact information. And this, the benefit there is to reduce error and fraud. Then the other possibility is avoiding the need to validate registrant data each time a registrant registers a new domain name, because I guess a lot of the time registrants are registering quite a lot of domain names. So, you know, if there could be some sort of system where that data was only validated, those data were only validated once, then that would be an improvement. Then at the bottom of the page, avoiding delay in the processing of a domain registration. If it's done before it, then that would be the benefit. Then we go on to page 4. And we are seeing things. Well, may this continue. And we're up at the top of page 24 now. And this is really, and that's displaying beautifully. Good. That makes things much easier. This is displaying just really more detail. So it's saying that often there are primary contact points for several roles. It really could be quite a few roles. And so the idea would be to allow the easy use of contacts like that. And then at the bottom of the page, there are recommendations for a pre-validation process. So we've got things like syntactic and operational validation carried out by the validator. And I'll just flag up. So the syntactic validation is doing things like checking whether an email address has an @ sign in it. And the operational validation is, can the email address actually receive email? That sort of thing. That then takes us on to page 25. And then we've got the identity validation, which is marked as optional, and this is the thing that can only really be done manually. The other two can be done automatically. So, you know, there may be a case for this to be done by validators. And then there is a specific suggestion that unique identifiers be used for validators. There are some sort of concrete suggestions about how that may work. Then, if we go forwards onto page 26, there are suggestions about processes, and you've got self-correction is one of them. Validators allowed to update information. Or some sort of monitored process where validators conduct periodic validation. And that then sort of slips into a system whereby you could have registration data flagged as inaccurate, and then the inaccurate flag would be replaced, would be removed if the data were updated so that it was they were again accurate. Nothing very much on page 27. And then if we go on to page 28, this is really it's a summary of some of the things we've just been discussing, but it adds new things. So I think probably the safest thing to do is to just go through this. And so this is the numbered sections on page 28. And so they're talking, in number one, they're talking about the unique contact identifiers that we already spoke about. Then in number two, it's being more specific and saying that they would be associated with discrete blocks of contact information. They would be, in number three, accredited entities by validators, registrars, registries, third-party validators. And then to be associated with a domain, one would have to have a contact ID under this model. And they can be assigned to the multiple roles we were talking about earlier in number five. The contact IDs would be created as part of the domain registration process. I think that's the idea there. And validated at the three levels, syntactic, operational, and identity, which we were just discussing a moment ago. I'm just going through. And then possibility of multiple levels of authentication. Oh, yeah, okay. So sort of no validation to high validation. I think that's the idea there. And then this thing about it could have a status of inaccurate, and that would then disappear if it were fixed. Number 11. And all the data elements have to be validated at least at the or at the syntactic level, email addresses having at signs, it's that sort of thing. And then number 13, we've got mandatory data elements must be validated operationally. Oh, yes, so it's things like, does the email address work? Before it can be used in relation to a domain name. And then we've got contact holder may seek higher levels of validation rather than just the minimum requirements. Okay, goodness. Perhaps it's a good moment to pause. We're about halfway through, but this, I'm just wondering whether there are any comments about this or whether it's just helpful for me to continue to go through and try and summarize and explain the rest of them. Well, let's continue. I think we are about more than halfway through, in fact. The idea of cross-field validation, so to some extent data in one field may be backing up data in another. I think that's the idea there. And then there may be a minimum of a certain number of fields that would be cross-field validated. And then talk of contact data should be revalidated on a regular basis. That's number 17. Then this talk of a mechanism for economically disadvantaged applicants to receive validation. Certainly, I mean, that's just alluding to the fact that this could cost money, these processes. So that's, that's sort of anticipating that. Okay, and then the validation status should be tracked and published when accessing the information. The list of possible statuses in the notes, but be quite... Yes, I'm rather interested where that's being published, how it's being tracked. There's some interesting ideas there. Okay, then if a contact holder provides optional information for collection, it must be at least syntactically and operationally validated. Okay, and then, oh yes, now this is interesting, number 21. A contact holder may choose any particular validator. I think that's quite interesting from a security point of view, because there is a bit of a feeling that if there was somebody wanting to register something data in some misleading way, they may choose a particular validator. So okay, and then that moves us into number 22, oversight and accountability policies would need to be developed, okay? And then some sort of procedure for changes to contact data here, so would need to be made by the contact holder via the currently designated validator. And then at the end we've got, so in order to combat impersonation and these various abuses, the contact holder may designate that their data are unique and should not be used by other claimants. Yes, I'm not a legal person, I'm not totally sure about the implications of that. Onwards and upwards. Then on page 30, the 26 round there. I think number 26 is just referring us further down, so we'll skip that just for the moment and have a look at number 27. And this is talking about potential levels of control. So public would be anybody can designate the contact ID as a contact for their domain. Verified would be the holder of the contact ID must be contacted. Restricted, contact ID can only be used by the contact holder. Okay, and then last but not least, we've got number 28, which is the contact holder should be able to request that the use of their contact ID be tracked or reported. Slightly concerned about number 26. Further analysis below. I'm actually rather puzzled by this. Well, let's go to the end of the section, and if that isn't picked up, I might need to come back to this because it's not totally clear in my mind. There is a thing on key benefits, and so this would be a more accurate RDS, greater data accuracy. Then on page 31, increased ability for individuals to control their data, then improved efficiency if there are multiple domain names, efficiency improvements for the entire system, and reduce abuse occurring via impersonation, and that brings us to the end of the section that I was intending to cover, but actually I don't think I have explained number 26 adequately, so unless somebody on the call actually understands what number 26 is, then I will put a note to myself saying I need to come back to you with this. Buddy, pardon that, I wonder. Looks as if that may be homework for next week. Okay. That being so, any questions about this document before we move on to the next one? Okay. As I say, I will come back to this one because I don't like there being things in something that, which I really can't begin to explain, and that did rather happen with this document, despite my best efforts. The next document we are intending to look at is a small snippet of the... it's basically the 2013 RAA... And it's only, it's actually the bit on the Who Is Accuracy program specification. And it's very short, and it just has some information on validation, which we've been meaning to look at for many weeks. So it's really great to be in the situation where we can at last do this. And I will try and find, yes, I've got a URL for that, so I will just paste that into the Adobe Connect so that it's handy in case we have any more technical problems. Now, that looks as if it's going to work. Yes. Okay, so that is the document we're looking at. Now, the pagination is rather strange in this document. So what you really need to do is find the bit which is on Who Is Accuracy Program Specification, which I think comes soon after page 41, but it doesn't actually have a page number. Okay, I realize this is difficult, so I'll just wait. And we're only going to be looking at, one page of this, but I'll just wait a moment for you to find it. Rudy is writing in the chat room that actually the URL I gave jumps you straight to the correct place. So that is a top quality URL, highly to be recommended. So if you can get that into a tab in your browser, we're all quite literally on the same page. Okay, right. So, and it's just looking at the current RAA validation specifications, and under number one, validate the presence of data for all fields required under subsection 3.3.1 in a proper format for the applicable country or territory. Starts to think about UPU immediately. I wonder if it's talking about that. I suspect it may be, but anyway, let's continue. Validate that all email addresses are in the proper format, and there's an RFC which specifies what that is. Something on telephone numbers which we don't need to worry about. Ah, yes, postal addresses, and this is UPU, and this is using the so-called S42 templates. Now, there's a lot more about those in the study to evaluate available solutions, and you can just see how those templates can be used. And And Rudy is making the interesting comment that validating the presence of the data doesn't actually give anybody much of an idea on the quality of data. So that's lovely. Yeah, thank you very much for that. I think that's an interesting point. Okay, and and as I was saying, the S42 address templates do also deal with. So if you've got an address where, you know, I was giving that German example earlier, where the German address order is actually different from English, so that is actually dealt with under that template. And there's actually an example in the study which shows this German address and the order of it being changed by the template. So that's all quite interesting. And then we have the validate that all postal address fields are consistent. Oh, I see. So it's the sort of street exists in the city, city exists in the state. City matches the postal code. It's that sort of practical thing. Then at the bottom, verify the email address of the registered name holder, and that's actually by emailing them, and then the telephone number, which we don't need to worry about too much. And I'll just double check, but I actually think that this was more or less all that I was intending to pick up. Okay, I think that's it. I've been meaning to do this document for so many weeks, I can't believe we've finally done it. Are there any comments about it? Now, that means that... now Rudy is typing something. Email address of the registered name holder. Rather strange. So, it would be quite interesting if whether that email address has the new domain name or not. There might be a necessity, you know, or at least not under this version of the RAA, but under future ones, that may be a possible improvement. But the email address would have to belong to the relevant domain. That is a really interesting idea. That.
Hello, Chris.
We've got bright sunlight in London, and I didn't see you'd put your hand up, but by all means, speak.
No problem, Chris. It's ready for the transcript. Based on the different documents and reports, it looks to me that we have to do some cross-validation of what is put in the reports. Because in some cases, I've discovered that there is a different interpretation in the different reports, and we need to put them aside each other in order to avoid that we are taking a decision based on one or the other report, where there is a conflict in interpretation of the text. And with regard to the last comment that I posted in the chat room about the verification of the email address. Very often, people are using the as a registrant name holder the new domain name and their email address related to that domain name. So, I'm wondering if that's how do they do the verification? It's something I would like to know, maybe some of the present participants in this call has any idea about how that can be verified.
Thank you for that, Rudy. I wonder if anybody happens to know the answer to that. Okay, well, I will try and be as careful as possible and hold on to that. So, you know, it's rather like, there are a few things that we need to follow up. I think that just we've got number 39, number 26, and now that. So I'll keep a list of these things that are hanging over us. And these are the sorts of things which tend to be easier to sort out at the face-to-face meetings. And luckily, we are only a few weeks away from one. Okay, well, we have a couple of minutes, but I am not going to start going through the study to evaluate available solutions because it really would be self-defeating. It's a very substantial document, and I think it will only cause confusion. The other thing is that there may be a case actually for asking somebody like Steve perhaps to present some of this. I mean, I'm happy to do it, but it's also good to have people who are directly involved, because if somebody else does it, there's always a danger that person reads it in a particular way. But as hoped, we will be looking at that next week, one way or the other. But I think that, Lars, you have something for any other business, so let me ask you if you'd like to do that now.
Thanks, Chris. This is Lars. Yeah, I mean, Julie and I both, I want to make sure that we have enough time. I think we have four issues altogether. The first one is the authors of the report that you went through today, specifically Steve Shang, have offered to give a presentation to the group if that's desired, and that maybe could be happening next week.
Thank you. The short answer to that is yes. That would be absolutely marvelous. I have prepared what I think about it. As I always go through and I write all over the document, so I've got lots and lots of comments, but it's really much better that people do it. If there is a report and they've been authors, then that is a better approach, so that's really welcome.
All right, great. We'll add that to the agenda.
Thanks.
And the second issue is the London meeting has been approved and is on the public schedule for the group to meet on Wednesday at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Now, having seen that, I've realized there's, in the room that we're meeting at, nothing is happening beforehand. And so I was wondering whether the group would consider extending the session by half an hour by starting at 8:30 and still going to 10. Because sometimes during the face-to-face meetings, we're losing about 20, 25 minutes for introductions. You're doing the round around the table. If there's people in the room that are new to the subject, often a general introduction is given. So, I cannot promise this at this time. If the group wanted me to ask Glenn, who's in charge of organizing this, there's a chance it will not happen because the schedule is already public. But I could set this into motion and see where we land.
Yes, I think that's a really great idea. Let's try it. With a good wind, nobody will spot this empty room. So yes, let's certainly try that.
I will make sure that I will try also to have some coffee and maybe some pastries available at that time. Although again, I cannot promise anything, but we'll see what we can do. Maybe some baked beans, seeing that we're in London.
Delicious.
Yes, absolutely. And then two other points. The first one, I suppose, is putting Rudy a little bit on the spot. We had some conversations off list on the week regarding the presentation to the GNSO on the weekend session. I know the council is coming together for its early June meeting, and the weekend session will certainly be on the agenda to discuss there later tonight. And I just wanted to double check with Rudy and with you also, Chris, that you want to go ahead to A, present, and B, have been in touch with Folker about this.
I mean, I'm certainly happy to at least be there or present. Don't mind either way.
Okay, I will then,
now I haven't been in contact with Folker.
Yeah, if you could just drop him, either of you, just drop him a line, just literally. I mean, I can do this too in CC if you wanted to, but he will have the confirmation from you two, seeing that it's going to be you that they'll be doing the brief presentation. I believe Judy has already started on also drafting some slides that might be useful.
I'll drop him a line. That's fine.
Okay. And then finally, whether we can already today, although we have only got 8 minutes left, or possibly have that on agenda for next week, just to briefly discuss what we want to talk about in London, because it's always useful for this meeting to have the agenda up, even if it's just a draft that we change later, to have the agenda up on the general meeting, because people who plan the London session, they will go through this, and so it'd be good to have something up there that we want to discuss. As a suggestion, we can always, obviously, the welcome roll call statement of interest, I suppose, would say the same. And if you want to, we can, for the time being, just put up an overview of the work so far, maybe a feedback on Steve's presentation from next week, and then continue discussion on the responses from the SONACs. And then if you wanted to, I would put that up, and then we can change it as we go along if need be.
Thank you. That sounds like a really good start, and we can then play around with it and add things as they come.
Yeah, exactly. But that way at least something would be up.
Yes. No, that sounds very good.
And then finally, sorry to take so much time, but the final point would be whether we wanted to meet in 2 weeks' time. So the 19th of June, usually the week before the meeting, people skip the weekly calls just because a lot of people will be in transit. I have a whole three-hour journey door-to-door this time, so I could meet on Thursday, and I suspect that Chris will even beat me to that. I put that out to the group, whether he wants to meet on the 19th or whether we should just meet next week, have the presentation from Stephen, and meet in London on the Wednesday morning.
I mean, in some ways, I'll be absolutely honest and say that I wasn't expecting that we would need to meet every week for so long. I think we have needed to do that. But in fact, I think my suggestion would be that we skip the 19th.
All right, sounds good. Rudy seems to agree in the chat. And I think this is all from Julie and I for any other business, unless Julie has something else, and hand it back over to you, Chris. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much for that. In that case, Julie is just confirming in the chat that she doesn't have anything else. So unless there's anything else anybody would like to raise, I think we can probably end this meeting slightly early, then we've got a week to have a slow read of Steve's report before he gives the presentation next week. I think it's really good to be looking at the script-specific parts of that report, because there are quite lengthy sections on specific scripts, so those are the ones, if you are involved with a particular script, then really focus on that, because that's, it's just a way of covering it more quickly. All right. Well, In that case, thank you very much for today. We've covered really a huge amount of stuff. I'm sorry for the technical problems, but even so, I think we made very good progress, and I look forward to next week and dealing with the studies report. Thank you very much indeed. Goodbye then.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
Thanks, all.
Once again,
thank you, Chris.
Today's conference call. Please disconnect all remaining lines at this time. Gail, if you could please stop the recording.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.